to you people. Starship Rokan Show with Anna DeVlantis right here on 720 WGN. All right, a lot going on here on the radio side, and we're about to be joined by the CLTV side here in just a few minutes to talk about the situation that goes on in the courtroom here at 26 in California with the Jason Van Dyke trial, which is just wrapping up for the day, and there are some interesting developments. Mike Monaco's with us. We're going to do that in just a moment when CLTV joins us. In the meantime, Tom Skilling, who is brought to us by PermaSeal Basement Systems, is going to join us a little early today because of all where the cameras are moving around. So we appreciate you stepping up for us.
Bro, it's great to talk to you and Anna. No problem at all.
You too, Tom. We're looking forward to sweating our butts off tomorrow.
Yeah, you know, right now. While it's,
wow, that was close.
I was going another direction?
It's a pleasant thought, isn't it?
I think of you, I thought of how hot it's going to be tomorrow, and I just connected some dots, but not necessarily the ones Roe was.
I like that, Anna. Mm-hmm. I think you're onto something
here. Stopped on that B. I heard her actually swerve.
Yeah.
Took a good
turn. That could have been a lot worse than it wound up. You know?
Right. Listen. It's going to be hot.
It's going to be awfully hot.
92 degrees tomorrow.
Probably 93, and we could break a record.
93.
It's 94 right now at Champaign. It's 90 at Marseilles. Isn't that something? And yet here we are in the low and mid-70s. So there's a warm front between us and those locations, and that's coming north tonight. Now, the good thing is there's big autumn storm that's lifting out of Colorado going by way of the Twin Cities through the Midwest. That puts us solidly in the windy, warm, humid sector tomorrow. But it also lifts the best chance of severe weather north and west of us. We could be brushed by a shower or storm tomorrow night. But if that had tracked a little farther south, it could have been an issue for us as we get out of this warm air late tomorrow evening and night. And the weekend looks lovely. It'll be cool, but bright and sunny.
But cool meaning 60s.
Yeah, 67 Saturday and 71 Sunday.
Oh, there's nothing wrong with that.
No.
I like that.
That's beautiful.
Just don't mention the lows, you know, because that would be.
Oh, you, what? Anna, you and I will step off to the side.
What? Yeah, just the
what
just keep it. Wait,
what did you say?
Anna, you and I will step to the side and talk about the suburban 40s expected Saturday and Sunday morning.
Shoot.
Oh, no. I thought we had hidden it from him, but, you know.
I heard that.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to wound you like that verbally, you know. But you know what? Hey, we've had a...
What's it going to be like in the city at night?
Probably low and mid 40s, or 50s.
Well, yeah.
Low and mid 50s. Yeah. So it'll be nice.
It is about this time of year, maybe in a couple weeks from now.
Yeah.
Where you go out, you're wearing like a light coat.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then you go to a restaurant, you go to a movie, you go to something.
Yes.
And you've been inside for a while and you step out. It's always around 10 o'clock at night.
I know.
And all of a sudden you get this like shiver up your spine that changes your chemistry. It's like a Marvel comic.
It's true.
And it's sort of like all of a sudden you're able then to take the cold.
Oh,
but
yeah.
You're the coldest you have ever been for about 5 minutes.
It turns.
Well, you know, we're lucky. We reside next to a giant body of water known as Lake Michigan, and that tends to hang on to some of the heat. So it kind of dampens the cooling a bit compared to what happens in the area surrounding. But you know, I think autumn is a lovely time of the year. The leaves are already changing up in northern Wisconsin to some extent. And, you know, another month they'll be changing here. And that's such a pretty time of the year.
It is. It's just not long enough. That's the only concern I have about our fall. But I do love it. I love this weather.
People are already asking about the winter and what may be coming. And, you know, a couple of thoughts on that.
Caterpillars?
Yeah.
Real furry? Because I think, isn't that one of the things we're looking for?
Your weather forecasting woolly caterpillars?
Yeah, my woolly caterpillar. Uh-huh. If it's got a lot of wool on it, it's going to be a cold winter. If it's wearing a bikini, it's not going to be a cold winter. Isn't there some deal like that?
Yeah.
You should call that into Skilling and let him know.
It's part of all
that.
He
can use that in his forecast.
Need all the help I can get, Anna, you know?
Sure.
Well, you know, and by the way, do you keep these woolly caterpillars in your bathtub the way you did the frogs?
The turtle.
That's right.
That's another
frog. The frog never made it out of tadpole, and that was in a tank next to the turtle.
I see. Well, a couple of, it's interesting to hear your woolly caterpillars and how they're doing and what they might be telling us. You know, though, the fact is insects and animals and all react to what's been going on up to the point you look at them.
Oh.
So to the extent that trend continues, it's predictive. But, you know, it doesn't always mean that that's the way it's going. But I'll tell you, we got a couple interesting things going. You know, the Weather Service looks at 7 different seasonal models. 2 of the 7 have us colder than average. The other 5 have us warmer than average. So that's a check on the warm side of the ledger. We've got El Nino. That generally leads to a warmer than average winter. That is a check there. We've got persistence. 7 of the last 9 months have been above average, 5 in a row. So persistence is at work there. And so there are some early indications that, you know, overall, the winter may not be barbaric.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you always get cold and snow. I don't care whether you have a warm winter or not at some point. But it sure doesn't look like we're setting up for, a barbaric winter at this point. But we've got a couple of months to look at some more stuff.
And, you don't really know, right? I mean, there's no
seasonal
real
seasonal forecasting is a devil, particularly when you get into precipitation. Because, look at the way that falls. It's the least evenly distributed of all of our atmospheric parameters. And so we see it definitely in the warm season where one area gets flooded and the area next door doesn't get a drop.
Yeah.
You know,
you see that here.
Yeah.
You can see that in Chicago metropolitan area. You
sure.
You see the north side, south side, totally different experiences in the summer.
Yeah.
This is, though, it feels like we had a fairly good winter last winter.
Yeah.
It wasn't good, crazy bad. The one before, we're on a bit of a run of mm-hmm. super cold and sort of spiky snow event kind of winters the last few years. But then we had this beautiful summer, and I'm always, I figured there's always a law of averages thing that kicks in here.
Well,
and it's going to ruin my day.
And it's interesting, Ro, you bring that up. We did a study because everybody always presumes if you had a hot summer, it's going to be a cold winter. And the fact is, we found that 60% of the winters that follow a warmer than average summer, which this one just completed was, winters tend to be above normal, too. So there's another factor to check on the warm side of the ledger.
Okay.
Now, having said that, you can throw in a cold month and a snowy month. We have no skill at forecasting that a season ahead of time. But I think when you close the books on it, you'll have found that maybe this will be another one of these above average winters. We'll see.
Yeah,
and I'll keep you posted on the thinking of that.
Okay.
Great.
All right.
Yeah.
As you get closer, there's other indicators.
Right? Oh, yeah. You know, for instance, El Nino, how's it going? Is it developing, the way
how's
it should?
Doing?
Is it persistent?
How's it going? Is it doing okay? Is it rolling? How about La Nina?
Yeah,
how's she doing?
¿Cómo estás, El Nino?
Exactly. How's it going?
Yeah.
You cute little baby. That's nice.
This is good. Look, I'm going to bring you two into the conversation I have with them when we do.
We'd like to participate.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So, but that generally means a lot of rain on the West Coast, though, right?
It can indeed. That's right. It brings some of those storms. But the fact of the matter is,
care about that? I don't know why I care about it. I like to watch. I like to have a 58 degree January, beautiful sunny day here, mm-hmm. and then watch a house slide off a mountain in California. It makes you feel better about not living there because when I watch like Oakland Raiders on a Sunday afternoon, or I watch
it's so
the
nice
LA,
and warm.
You know, the LA Rams are now the LA Chargers. It's you're like, oh man, I wish I was. Look at that. Look at how beautiful that is. Oh man. Or the parade, the Rose Parade. And you're like, oh, look out here. It's awful. And look there. Oh man. And then you have there's either a fire or a flood or an earthquake or something.
Yeah. What a humanitarian you are, Mr.
I want to feel better about
I'll tell you.
I want to feel better
about
myself.
As long as we're 58 degrees, let our neighbors out in the West slide into the ocean. Just a really nice.
Great attitude.
I got a bad attitude. I know. I got friends who got houses on the sides of mountains.
I know.
All right.
Sure. They're going to love you for that comment. I'll tell you
all
that.
Right. Thank you very much. Appreciate
it, guys.
Tom.
All right.
There he goes. Tom Skilling. He couldn't get out of here fast enough. All right. Let us now check in with Judy. What's coming up at the bottom of the hour? On the WGN News.
November 6th, you have the power to influence the course of politics by following the most comprehensive local political news online, chicagotribune.com/midterms.
All right. We're going to join, or They're going to join us. I don't know. Either way, CLTV is about to join us. We're going to do a wrap-up of the Jason Van Dyke trial today that has just adjourned for the day. What happened in it? What do you need to know? We'll explain all that coming your way. But first, Judy Pollack, season two. All right. We have got Mike Monaco with us here in the studio. And the Jason Van Dyke trial is in recess at the moment. We thought it had ended for the day. May not. The judge is Judge Gaughan, who's a no-nonsense. Is that a best way to describe him?
Yeah, I think that's right.
No-nonsense judge is keeping everything to the vest. He's got everything in his own orbit here, and he does not letting outside courtroom issues like the live coverage of it or anything like that get in the way of how he wants the jury to be. Or to be, to feel and to see all the things he can do. I mean, it's an interesting job that the judge has because he has to basically be the advocate for the jury, right?
Yeah, I credit all the folks over there with having the live TV coverage of it. I think that's a good thing. I think it's a very good thing. So I'm happy that he's doing that. And I Judge Gaughan does like to have a lot of private conversations with the lawyers in his chambers, and that's unfortunate, but that's how he is.
But that's not unusual, is it?
It's somewhat unusual. I mean, he's more secret about things than most judges, I would say. Although he's done a good job, I think, so far.
Here's a moment where Judge Gaughan, is this from today or is this from yesterday? Today, where Judge Gaughan did not like the theatrics of the prosecution's case.
In fact, a trauma team actually cut open his chest.
All right, stop. That's enough. Move on.
Well, did those five doctors work on him for practice, or were they trying to help a person remain alive?
Yes. As to the form of the question, sustained. You have to establish that he was alive at the time if you want to go into it.
Did any of the doctors tell you when the five of them were working on Laquan McDonald that they were working on a dead person?
Objection. Sustained. Stay away from this right now, all right? Ask him if he had any personal knowledge whether Mr. McDonald was alive or dead, all right? And stop the drama, too,
Ooh.
All right?
Ouch.
That's
a warning.
That sounds like Judge Gaughan. Yeah, that sounds just like Judge Gaughan.
Yeah. Well,
because he's used to dealing with murder cases.
Sure.
I mean, they do it every day.
Do you think that things are anything about this would be changed because it's televised? Because that's always the fear and the justification in the past when they've not allowed cameras is that people act for the cameras or that things get more dramatic.
That's what you're exactly right. That's what they say. It's not been my experience, and friends of mine in New York and other places where they have televised trials, it's not been their experience. They say what it does is it heightens everybody. Everybody's more ready. Everybody's ready to perform and not go beyond the ordinary dramatics that you would have in a courtroom. And this is a pretty dramatic event. I mean, young man died.
Right. And the camera coverage of this, it's not like OJ, right? I mean, that became a cottage industry. That became its own economy, its own ecosystem. And this is, this is a trial that is going to, probably last 3-4 more trial days, perhaps, before.
Right. It's going to be over soon.
Yeah. And so this is not a,
that's good you brought up OJ. Remember in OJ, when one of the prosecutors wore a medal on her chest or some ornament on her chest in sympathy for the victim. And I think the victim's family is also wearing the same thing on her chest. The judge in that case took 45 minutes of argument over whether she should be allowed to wear.
Gaughan wouldn't do that.
Would say, take it off. Let's go. That's all it would be.
Take it off for now.
That's
we'll
all.
Deal
take
with
it
later.
Off.
Right. I think that's where we had the dancing Itos.
Yeah, exactly.
Back in the mid 1990s. All right, let's talk about what was at stake there, though. This is an interesting point.
Right, it is interesting. When the gentleman when
did Laquan McDonald die? And the question is. At the time, you notice Chicago police officers, and this is not going to I don't think, play well, even though this may not have to do specifically with Jason Van Dyke. It certainly does not portray the Chicago Police Department in the best light, that after this kid, even with a knife and all of the, you know, the justification that a lot of people in the police department feel was rightful in terms of the shooting of Laquan McDonald, if not for 16 times, but at least in the initial shots, it seems to me that there is a kind of a negative impact of them standing there around him as he's on the ground.
Nobody went to save
no
him.
No one went to save him until a sheriff's officer, right. A sheriff's police officer,
came by.
Arrived.
Wasn't even assigned to the scene. He just showed up.
Well, they're assigned to that area. They are in that sector.
Yeah.
But he saw the police who were being called to the scene. He wasn't called to the scene, and he showed up.
Yeah,
but no one else rendered aid. He was the guy who did it.
And you'd have to, I'm not sure if that's common in police shootings. It seems to be common that it doesn't happen, right? That nobody rushes. If someone is shot, nobody rushes to the scene to help them. Or it's unlike, it's
but
not
when you
a common
see that in
thing.
A video, it may not
you've
be common.
Video,
but
you've
seen
tough.
A video, it's very tough. And Chicago Fire Department paramedic said this on the stand.
You applied a monitor?
Yes, sir.
What did you find when you applied a monitor?
On a monitor, I believe he had a rhythm. Yeah, possibly in the 60.
Okay, he had a rhythm.
Yes, sir.
What do you mean by a rhythm?
He had a heart rate. There was a pulse, and it showed on the cardiac monitor.
Okay. And approximately what was his rhythm or heart rate at that time?
I believe it was like 60. I don't know exact number.
And when you say 60, is that beats per minute? Or?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so if by the time CFD has gotten there, fire has gotten there, and they put him up on the gurney and they get him into the truck and they start wiring him up, if he has a pulse rate of 60, the argument could be that he was certainly alive when he was on the ground.
Right, and that your point is right, is well taken, that nobody did anything to try to save him. What does that mean? Is that now? It's not just Van Dyke that did nothing. None of the other policemen were there did anything.
But how does that work into these charges against
Van Dyke? It hurts Van Dyke because it makes it look like they didn't care, that he did not care if this fellow lived or died. And that's what it sounds like.
Well, but there were other officers there.
And none of them cared.
But
is Van Dyke, though, is the shooter in a situation like that, when a police officer shoots somebody, justified, let's just assume in a justified shooting. I thought at that point they're supposed to not be a part of anything that goes on here.
I think that's right, although normally it's just one or two policemen are there. Now here you have five or six policemen there, so it's different.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's just, you're right, if it's just one other, if it's the fellow who did the shooting should not be involved in, I suppose. But here, the whole point is this: it goes to intent. Was it their intention? Was it Officer Van Dyke's intention to kill this young man? That's what the state has to prove.
Does it go the other way, though? Is there a way that the defense here can say, well, you know, he shot him 16 times, but he didn't initially kill him? Now, I guess the question is, and I don't know where they're going to go here with the testimony in terms of pathology, but is the question that he needed to neutralize the threat, so he does. This kid had a knife. He was moving a beam them, and then appears to be turning toward them. That's when the shots are fired, and that's when he goes.
If
down.
He had only shot Laquan McDonald once and he fell to the ground,
mm-hmm.
Would we have a murder case?
No, I don't think we
probably
would.
Probably not. No. Stacey St. Clair with the Tribune, who's doing some excellent reporting on this, said that today the defense really focused on trying to convince the jury that those two lethal shots came while Laquan McDonald was still standing
early.
And still a threat, meaning number two and number four, I think they were isolating. Right. And so they're trying to say that that's when those are the ones that actually killed him. Those are the lethal shots.
You remember we talked about this months ago when we first heard about this. I said at the time, if the first shot killed him, then the defense could say the other 15 shots are irrelevant. Doesn't matter.
Well, but
he still has to explain why he did them. And I don't know. I don't think in their opening statement he didn't explain it.
No.
So we'll see if they're going to call.
Do you think he'll be on trial? Do you think he'll go on?
He's going to testify. I don't think he has to testify. I'm curious what he'll say. Why he kept shooting. I don't think he can say why he kept shooting.
Well, there isn't. People have speculated that there are going to be witnesses here that are going to testify to the psychology
right.
of these incidents,
that these things make people act in a different normally
the
not
tunnel vision
right.
concept that right. that they're only all of the exterior things that are happening around them go away. The context goes away. All they know is
that police trainers are going to say that they're trained to keep shooting.
Right.
They're trained to shoot
and to reload, which he did.
They're trained to keep
shooting.
Even
the witness on the scene who said that it looked like Laquan was walking away said he couldn't remember how many shots it were. He said a few. I mean, right. it's hard to even know when you're in that scene.
Well, the shots came so fast, too.
Right. And that weapon does fire quickly. I mean, you can empty that weapon in just a matter of seconds,
sure. Yeah. And so I guess it will come down to why did he shoot 16 times after the first couple of shots? Why did he keep shooting?
After he was on the ground.
After Laquan McDonald's on the ground. But my point is, other policemen at the scene, I'm told, are going to say, and although this hasn't come into evidence yet, hold your fire.
Hmm. Even though there's no, is there any audio to reflect that?
There is no.
There's no audio of anything.
That's the funny thing. There is no audio.
All right. Well, let's see. We'll see what comes in evidence. But at this point, what we're looking at is the issue of dead or alive at the scene. And once fire arrived fairly quickly.
Right.
So you had the sheriff's officer. Step up and put on, he testified yesterday, he put on some rubber gloves and right. he went down and tried to see if he could administer some.
And he told McDonald that the ambulance was coming.
Right. And he didn't seem to think that there was much of a response from Laquan McDonald that moment.
Right.
He seemed to be unconscious at that. But when they got him into the
ambulance, he was still alive.
Right. The human body is amazingly resilient in those last moments of life. In terms of heartbeat and stuff like that. I mean, people who've had sad vigil with people who are going to pass away. You know, it's pretty amazing.
Well, this is such a traumatic event. I mean, 24 times bullets went through this fellow's body. I mean, 16 shots, 24 different bullet holes.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So this fellow suffered a great, horrible trauma within the last few minutes of his life. So it's hard to say how he was going to survive that.
Mike Monaco, do you think that these last couple of days, this is the prosecution's main case
here? Yes, absolutely.
Is it going well for them?
This is their case. Why did he shoot 16 times? And that's the question that the defense will have to answer. Why he shot 16 times? Now, are they going to call experts? I think they may want to call experts because I can't imagine, although they may.
Is Gone going to let them do that?
They may, yeah.
I mean, can you really call an expert that gets into the mind of somebody who's not testified? Doesn't the defendant at this point have to testify to a state of mind? You can get an expert to training as to how
police officers train.
Right.
And you get an officer, you can get someone to say that this is not unusual that a person keeps shooting because policemen are taught that way, and this is how policemen and the psychology of it is. Once you're in this dramatic, horrible situation, this most stressful situation of your life, how are you going to act? It's hard to say how you're going to act.
All right, let's get a couple answers here from people who actually do this job. Nick is a police officer. Nick, you're on WGN. Go ahead, sir.
Hey, thank you, guys. To clarify, I have law enforcement experience. I am not currently at law enforcement status.
Okay.
But I think what's important to discern here is the definition of lethal force and the interpretations of what that means. Just as a quick starting point, a police officer is trained to apply lethal force when the threat of great bodily harm or imminent death is still present. So what he has to answer is why there was still an imminent threat of bodily harm and death throughout every single shot. And I think that it's apparent that his continued movement or threat to the other officers ended quite earlier than that. And then as far as duty of care goes, through training, they definitely show police officers other officer-involved shooting videos. But the simple oath that a police officer swears way back when they first started is to protect human life. So no matter who you are, whether you were the one that pulled the trigger, and I'm only speaking of this through other officer experiences, you immediately follow up with that medical care. I've personally seen videos where right after a justified use of deadly force was administered by an officer, he immediately put on his gloves, and I'm talking seconds. And through the stress in his voice, you could hear that he really did want to save that person and was upset at the decisions that everyone had to make that day. But it's important to know that you do know as an officer, you immediately follow up with medical care, and you also stop shooting when somebody stops being a threat.
Nick, would all officers, though, have that kind of training, CPR type of training, in order to be able to do that?
Absolutely. It's called first responder medical training.
They all have it.
And the most important, they do have it. And the most important way they're taught it, actually, is for each other. So the use of tourniquets, ever since mass shootings, have been more heavily looked at training-wise. Every officer is trained to react to major wounds.
All right. Thank you very much. Helpful. Appreciate it. All right, let's check in now with Judy, find out what's coming up at the top of the hour.
A disgraced former Chicago police commander has died.
This is a Delta trauma flow sheet that we use on all trauma patients that came in.
And you put in the information in this sheet, correct?
Correct.
And this is the sheet from Laquan McDonald, right?
Correct.
All right, and it shows up on the upper left-hand corner that when he came into the hospital, he had no pulse. Correct. He had no heartbeat, correct?
Correct.
So he was dead when he came to the hospital, right?
Correct.
That is testimony today. That is the attorney, Randy Ruckert, who's talking to the chief RN from the hospital. Laquan McDonald was taken to the night of the shooting. And Mike Monaco joins us. We're recapping what happened in the trial today of Jason Van Dyke on both WGN and CLTV. And I want to go back to this notion, if we can, just for a second here, about the importance and which side benefits more from the notion that Laquan McDonald died on the scene versus died during transport.
I think the main issue there is about the police, and especially Mr. Van Dyke, not going to seek help for Laquan McDonald. In other words, he was already dead. There was no need to seek, no need to do any CPR, anything on the scene, because it would have been of no value. I assume that's why they're bringing
it. And the prosecutors here would argue that because he didn't try to save him, that went to his intent to murder?
That's what I think they're going to argue, that they didn't care. I say they. I mean, it's just Mr. Van Dyke.
Right. But in this particular... But there were other officers there who could have rendered it, and it took a county sheriff's officer, who at the time it would be tough to distinguish at that moment.
Right.
Right, for anybody. But who did at least said to him, hey, the ambulance is on the way, because they knew that fire was rolling immediately on shots fired.
Ambulance was coming. So it's... You know, this is a very, very quick incident. We talked about this yesterday. There's not much evidence here. The biggest issue is that the policeman shot 16 times. That's the biggest issue. And the second issue is, why didn't anybody go to help him? Why didn't Officer Van Dyke then go to try to help the fellow he had just shot 16 times? Either because he realized that his shots had killed him, or because he didn't care. So that either side can argue either way. I mean, the state's going to argue they didn't care. This goes to their intent. I say there. It's only one person's intent,
right?
Van Dyke's intent.
Well, I mean, I think this is one of the things that when we have this debate, which we're having so much more now because of the ubiquity of video in these cases, is the behavior of police in the aftermath of a shooting. And it seems that in a case where you do have the victim lying there on the ground unattended, and we've seen this before.
Oh yeah, police are going to have to change. They're going to have to change their procedures. They're going to have to, with the advent of cameras, they're going to have to act after a shooting like they care to save the person who's shot. As the officer who just called in, a former officer, said, their number one duty is duty to care, duty to help people. that's what they have to do.
I talked to a police officer, though, just while we were in the break here, texted me and said that they learn in the academy CPR, but that there isn't, in his case, he didn't learn later. Again, you're not necessarily refreshed on your CPR and your, you know, first responder duties. And he said that he typically sees they wait for the paramedic if they're only minutes away to do that. That seems...
I suppose that's true, because there's not much they can do. What could a police officer have done to help?
And can they make it worse? I mean, that's the other thing. Fear that you
if,
have.
If you move him at all,
yeah.
If you move him at all, it could make it worse.
Right. So yeah. I mean that becomes a question, and that becomes a generally a civil litigation issue, right?
At some point too. Right.
But the real issue here is justifiability. Mm-hmm. Was the firing of the weapon justifiable?
If the first shot was justified, and if that killed him, you know, then there is, I think Herbert said in his opening statement, it's not a crime.
So one of the, on Windy City Live today, one of the activists, the primary activist of this case, one of the guys who was able to get the video released, was on the program with us. And the argument is being made here, and we'll have a chance, I think, to talk to him tomorrow. And I know they're planning a protest on Monday at the court. The argument is made that the police were, you know, the other police weren't shooting. There was another officer following behind Laquan McDonald on foot. The officer who had been in the police vehicle that Laquan McDonald had punctured the tire of and actually then, you know, stabbed without much impact the windshield of that vehicle as well. But, you know, clearly Laquan McDonald was, we now know, but he was, you know, he was on PCP and he was a little out of his mind, right, at this moment. He did have this knife. He had displayed this knife. And people were like, well, it's, you know, it's a pocket knife. It's a 3-inch knife. What is it? It doesn't really count. And that police officer didn't shoot at Laquan McDonald, the one from behind. And I said, well, if Laquan McDonald had turned around and approached that officer, he would have shot. Well, that's speculation, and it was told, and it's also a hypothetical. But the point is, the knife is the threat. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to just point out that the knife, in this case, is a deadly weapon. A three-inch blade is a deadly weapon.
It is absolutely deadly weapon. And it's not just the knife. It's the fact that of how he was dealing with the knife. He was using it as a weapon. I mean, that's why he had the knife. He's not holding it in a defensive posture. He's using it in an aggressive posture.
Right. But you have other police officers at the scene who chose not to use lethal force, and you wonder how convincing that will be to the jury.
That's
true. You can
say
there are different vantage points, different perspectives, and I think that's what the partner of Jason Van Dyke argued, that you don't see it from my vantage point. There's no body cam available, but you do have a number of police officers who did not use lethal force. I just, you know, that testimony is there, and you wonder how compelling that will be to the jury.
That'll be the issue. Was the shooting justified? If it was justified, the issue, the fact that he did 16 times, how does that control the issue? It may be that the prosecutor is going to say it means that he was in. This shows why he should be convicted of murder, because he was intending to kill this fellow. The defense will say no. If he had shot the first time and that was a fatal shot, the other shot's really irrelevant. You know.
Will the jury buy that, though?
No, they have to. I think somebody's got to explain why he shot him 16 times. Either, like we talked about earlier, either it's the emotion of it, the trauma of that the police officer is going through with his own trauma. This is a traumatic event for him.
Right.
Having
his family.
First time ever shooting a gun in the line of duty. So it's a traumatic thing for everybody, but is that going to justify the 16 bullets? Hard to say.
All right. Eric Rung has been following the story for us, for WGN Radio, WGN TV, and CLTV. And he's joining us now from the WGN TV newsroom. And it is interesting today. There was a lot of the big headline today, as we've just been discussing, is about the timeline of death here. But also at the very end of the day, they brought back one of the technical witnesses here. This is an FBI witness who was testifying about the videotape that shows the puffs of smoke with the during the firing of the gun at Laquan McDonald. They threw that testimony out yesterday. Now they're bringing it back in. What happened there, Eric?
So before court got started today, the judge met with both the attorneys for the defense as well as the prosecution. The prosecution had asked the judge to reconsider throwing that testimony out. The judge said, well, it was really confusing. I wasn't really quite sure what they were trying to say. But, you know, I'll think about it. And then eventually he said, OK, we will allow him to testify, but on a limited basis. Now, the one thing that was really the point of contention yesterday was this FBI video forensic expert started testifying on bullets and the bullets that he had put green arrows on that he said were coming out of Laquan McDonald. There were puffs of smoke. You heard that yesterday several times.
And that's an exit wound, right? Is
right.
that what that had been?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. However, the defense came up and they said, wait a second, you're a video expert. You're not a ballistics expert. How do you know this? And the prosecution today, when they went in to talk with the judge, said, we understand why you threw it out yesterday. However, his testimony is consistent with the medical examiner's reports. That is why the judge allowed him to testify once again here today. So the testimony could be on the record. But again, it wasn't a very limited form. You'll remember yesterday, he was probably on the stand for a good half hour, 45 minutes. The jury saw the video of Laquan McDonald being shot by Jason Van Dyke over and over again.
Slow motion, wasn't it?
Slow motion, yes, exactly. So regardless, whether or not they saw that again here today or not, if it would have been thrown out, the jury had already seen it.
But that's the hard part, I think. The judge in this case today said, completely disregard what you heard from this same expert yesterday, even his name, and let's start from scratch. And I always feel like that's really hard for a jury to do.
Okay, we're just going to unring that bell.
Yeah.
That slow motion video we saw for half an hour.
Eric, I thought the prosecution today also said that they're going to call the ballistics expert, who the forensics person, the video forensic person,
sat with. Right.
Right. So is it they're going to call the ballistics person himself?
That I'm unaware of. All I'm aware of is what I was told happened between the attorneys and the judge and why he was allowed to testify today. That would make sense for them to definitely call that ballistic expert that he did sit with to make those decisions on where to put those green arrows.
But may I ask a question here, just in Mr. Monaco, in terms of watching this videotape by the jury over and over and over again. I know we talked about this the first day of the trial, but now here we are on the third day of testimony. Does watching that tape over and over and over again dull the jury to what is happening here?
It could.
Or does it further?
It could. It could. I mean, your point is, is it overkill by the state to keep showing it, or is it some way helping the defense to keep showing it?
Right.
It's hard to say. I think it is such a...
There isn't like a hard and fast rule on
it. No, no hard and fast rule. It's clear that when someone sees a violent act over and over again, the person, it starts, it's less emotional as the first time you see it.
Right. It's inoculated to him.
But there's somewhat inoculated to it. But it's hard to say because this is such a... It's a very short thing, and so it's a very short period of time, and so it's important that the jury for the defense, excuse me, for both sides, it's important that the jury understands what happened.
And this is the this particular video that we're talking about here with the puffs of smoke, which are the exit wounds of that's the blood and tissue, it's not smoke, that's coming through there, it appears to be. That is, you know, as that's being explained, I mean, this is the most gruesome part of this,
right,
and certainly the most violent part of this. And to your point earlier, if you want to, you know, talk about, you know, does a guy who's hopped up on PCP, who's carrying a knife, who, you know, the people see this video two different ways. Some people see this video as he's walking away from the police and just trying to get away. Which you're not going to let him get away with a knife, right? No one's going to let him do that and go back toward a fast food restaurant or a strip mall, which is, you know, a couple hundred feet away from where he was actually shot, or then there's the, you know, the people who say, well, he was turning, stepped on the line, he turned his shoulder, he was about to lunge at the officers when they took the shot, which is what their paperwork showed. And the video, you know, I think the argument that the defense is going to use is that the video is really not conclusive in that.
Right, right. And that's what Walsh was saying yesterday, that from his view and Van Dyke's view, the victim seemed to turn towards them and raise his arm. That's what he said.
Or open his shoulders to them raise his arm. My question on that is, when the prosecution went to redirect Officer Walsh, or former Officer Walsh, why they only asked him that one question of why don't we see that on the video, and he said, well, that's not my perspective. Why not go further on that? I mean, regardless of what the video shows, I mean, and the arm is still an arm, and you could see it go up or down when Officer Van Dyke comes out. I didn't understand why there was no follow-up questions there.
Well, they don't control that. I mean, you know, normally policemen are in the hands of the prosecutor. Here, this policeman, Officer Walsh, or former Officer Walsh, was not in their hands, and so they were afraid of him, frankly.
So they just weren't sure of the answer. That's why they didn't ask a question.
But he'd been given immunity,
yeah,
hadn't
didn't he? Do an immunity
He'd been given immunity, but I'm sure he had been coached by the defense as well, you know, because the defense asked him questions like, which the key question was, somebody had to stop him, didn't they? And he said, yes, somebody had to stop
him.
Yeah, he was a dangerous man. Yeah. Correct. Yes.
All right, Eric, thank you very much. Appreciate it, sir.
Thanks,
Eric Rung from WGN-TV, WGN Radio, CLTV. We're all part of one gigantic item. And Mike Monaco, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
We appreciate you.
Nice
spending
to
your time here.
You too, Mike.
Thank you. This has been
always
the,
like to see you.
See you tomorrow.
Yes, we will see you tomorrow. There's more of this. And we don't know if there's actually going to be trial on Friday. It is unclear at this writing if that is actually going to happen. Would you anticipate, just quickly here, a couple more days of prosecution?
Yes.
And then do you think the defense will mount a long case or short case?
I think the defense, I don't know. Normally from an opening statement, you get some idea of what the defense is going to do, but you couldn't tell from this opening statement whether they're going to call experts.
And it depends on how they thought this went.
Or whether they're going to call other witnesses or not. Again, if they call Officer Van Dyke, he could be on half a day. But it's you know, I just don't know what he would say that would help him. I mean, even it's very hard for a person who committed an act to say why he committed it. You know what I'm saying? Why did you shoot 16 times? I was afraid. After the 14th time, were you afraid? After the and you could see a difficult cross examination for him.
Sure, you could. But sometimes it's helpful too for the jury to have the answer about why.
Maybe they'll figure out some way to put it in without having him testify.
More details to come. Thank you all very much. Let's check in with Judy. What's coming up at the bottom of the hour?
Be sure to check out the CB app. Hit up Facebook. Tell Chicago's Best TV where you like to eat. Watch Chicago's Best Sundays at 10 p.m. on WGN-TV. Your pick just might be Chicago's Best.
Procon Show with Anna DeVlantis right here on 720 WGN. All right, the trial's wrapped up in the Cook County Courts today of Jason Van Dyke. Now we turn our attention to what's happening in Washington, D.C., where Senator Grassley has just rejected the Democrats' call to delay Monday's hearing of Judge Kavanaugh and the accuser. If the accuser does arrive to that, we're not sure at this point if she will. And we'll just have to see where this goes from here. Mark McKinnon from The Circus will join us coming up in just a few minutes to discuss that. And also what we saw on Sunday night, if you watch The Circus, Steve Bannon in a virtuoso performance on The Circus. He's got a new documentary out that he'd like everybody to see in defense of Trump. I don't know. Does Trump still talk to Bannon? I didn't get the sense. I don't know. We'll have to
Don't get that sense either. It would be a good question. He seems to do a lot of international travel, the Steve Bannon, doing speaking.
Yeah. Yeah. There are dictators all over the world that would like his counsel. If that doesn't scare us, I don't know what will. All right. Let us now check in with Judy Pilak. She's standing by. She's got WGN News in 2. Oh, man. Back to Washington. I don't think I can catch a break.
But I've missed The Circus. It's been a it's It's been a summer without it.
Yes.
So much happened, and now it's back.
That's true. Thank God. I would like the circus to be on every week just to make me feel better that I'm not actually losing my mind, that other people are losing their mind with me. And I get why they can't be, but because they're going to die just doing 1 week of this at a time. And it's the pace at which and the breadth of this story, because for people who have not seen it on Showtime, the whole idea here is that this group of three or four different reporters, and some of them are reporters and some of them are former campaign specialists, you know, go out and they get interviews about whatever's happening in that week. And that could be really far flung. You could be overseas and getting an interview. Or last week, you had John Heilman sitting there with Steve Bannon at Steve Bannon's house. Well, Steve Bannon can't figure out how to work the TV. And it was the damnedest thing I have ever seen, Mark McKinnon. The damnedest thing.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Yes, you're right. If we did any more episodes than we're already doing, we'd have to do it from the hospital.
Really true.
You fit a lot in, that's for sure.
No, I tell you, I mean, this week was a good example of how difficult this show is to do, and because we have to be so nimble. Part of what we're doing this fall is covering the midterms, and so we want to focus on different parts of the country and different races. And so this week we were going to focus on Florida, just because they got big governor's race, Senate race, House races that are really important, and just because of Florida's importance historically, politically, and culturally with everything that's going on there. We got there, and while we're on the plane, the Kavanaugh news breaks, and 4 hours later we turn around and fly back to D.C. I mean, it's, you know, so...
What do you know? Let's talk about what broke today, because this obviously, you know, you're Wednesday. You got plenty of time, Mark. Don't worry about it. Yeah, you have till 8 o'clock on Sunday to figure this out. As we understand it, Chuck Grassley has now informed everybody involved in this that they are expecting a hearing on Monday. The accuser here says that she would like an FBI investigation before she sits down, and basically Grassley saying, hey, you're invited. You want to be here on Monday, be here on Monday, because Kavanaugh's going to be there on Monday, we understand. Is that your understanding as well?
That's correct. And I just left Senator John Kennedy's office. He's from Louisiana. 30 years ago, when I was trying to figure out what to do with my life, a mentor said, if you think you know anything about politics, go to Louisiana and get your PhD. And I did, and I worked on a campaign for governor, a guy named Buddy Romer, and I worked with John Kennedy, who's now in the United States Senate and who's on the Judiciary Committee. And so I talked to him about this, and my main question was this. So you're pushing ahead with the vote, with the hearing on Monday and a vote on Wednesday, and you say you want to know the truth and you want all the facts, and yet unless you have an FBI investigation, it's just he said versus she said. So I don't know how you get facts out of that or how you learn anything more. And during Anita Hill, they did an FBI investigation in 3 days. And also for John Tower, when something, you know, new information broke, the FBI got involved. So, I mean, the optics of this, I think, are difficult for the Republicans because it looks like they're rushing to it. You know, I understand that they're sort of saying, well, you know, she's had to get her chance to talk, but... Yeah, I can also understand she's getting death threats and, you know, that she wanted to be anonymous. She never wanted to be in the limelight like this. So I think it's fair to say, you know, she'd like a little bit more time. On the other hand, you can also see the Republican view, which I think a lot of people are, you know, accept, which is this is a last minute, you know, thing. And there's no question it's last minute. So people are suspicious just because of the timing of it. Although when you kind of TikTok all the timing and the rationale for that, apparently a rationale anyway. But anyway, so this is classic, you know, Washington stuff, but it's high stakes and it's important. And, you know, it could have real consequences long range for this election and for both the Republican and Democratic parties.
Dr. Ford is asking for this in lieu. She won't testify or won't come forward until the FBI does this additional background check. But only I understand that the White House has to order that, and doesn't seem as if they're going to do that. Does that show you there's some confidence that this will sail through without it? Is that what you think Republicans are thinking?
I guess so. Although I got to say, if you're Susan Collins or Lisa Murkowski, two women Republican senators, that makes it more difficult for me, I think, if I'm one of them, because I think they want to be able to say it's got a complete and fair hearing. And, you know, the Grassley saying at the same, you know, so we can investigate this. Well, they can't investigate it like the FBI does and can and has done before. So,
but he wants a vote
for the FBI getting involved.
And let me start. Yeah, there is a precedent for it, and there is a. But let me stop you on this point. They want to vote within the next couple of weeks, right? Because TikTok here.
Right.
So they can they investigate it in those couple of weeks? And as you're pointing out, if the FBI can get in and do this in 5 days as opposed to three, given the two extra, because there's not too much here. They're not going to be, there's no forensic evidence that they have to look at. No. This is, they're just looking at witness testimony. She's going to have to identify where this party was, approximately
was
when
party,
it was.
Where was it?
Yeah, and who was
and
there.
Was it and who was there.
Yeah. And they, and this, and the FBI is going to be able to try to track this down. It is, you know, the president is a victim of his own rhetoric here in some respects, because he's been asking the FBI to investigate everything, right? All of his enemies.
Yeah, right,
and so
yeah.
It's really hard now to say, well, I can, you know, we can't have the FBI doing that. You know, they're busy trying to investigate
my attorney general. Point. They can do anything else but this.
Yeah.
Hey, that's a good point.
Right. And that, the politics of that, or the optics of that are bad. And it's just in the optics for women. Women and men see this very differently. And like I think in a lot of ways, like the Me Too movement and other things, I think there's a lot of guys that are stunned by the amount, because this does seem like it's 36 years old. It's a long time ago. What happened at a party? I mean, does it actually count if this is not part of a pattern and practice of behavior? And there doesn't seem to be anybody else popping forward here like Me Too. You know, it was like, you know, Harvey Weinstein, one thing came out and then 40 more came out within days, or, you know, or Bill Cosby or some situation like that. This does seem to be a one-off accusation and not a pattern of behavior. And does that really count? But when I bring that up to women, present company included, I get this look like, well, sit down for a second. Let's hear this thing out, because women have experienced this, you know, in ways that we don't think that they, if, you know, we weren't there, we don't think they did.
I think you want to believe that there's a fairness to the process. And I think it is hard not to look at this one through slightly a political lens, and potentially even there's a lot of feelings of payback after the Merrick Garland situation, certainly coloring a lot of people's views on this. There's no doubt. And that I think you believe the accuser and you believe what he says. And I think there's a tough job for senators trying to figure out this confirmation. But I just want to, you saw George W. Bush, and I know you're very close to the Bushes, talk about, stand up for this guy and said he's of great character, he'll make a superb justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. He's starting to pick up people like that coming forward to say, get this done. It seems I'm hearing from that.
All right, so.
Yeah, I, by the way, I know and worked with Brett Kavanaugh, and I think he's outstanding. I think he has great character. I think he'd be a terrific Supreme Court justice. And by the way, I tell my Democratic friends, I said, you know, you be careful what you're asking for here, because if he goes down, I bet that the White House doubles down and gets somebody much more ideological and more conservative than Kavanaugh. So, but here's a question for you all that I pose. To me, it seems like the better response from Kavanaugh would have been not outright denial, but say, because then you're saying that this woman is a liar. I think the better approach might have been to say, listen, I don't recall that party at all. I have no recollection of that incident. You know, if it happened, I mean, there's a possibility I was at a party and I was 17 and I was really drunk and maybe was exercising some inappropriate behavior, but I don't remember it, which is not a good excuse. But I, you know, and I mean, would that have been survivable?
No, because you can't say sexual assault is okay if you're drunk. And so it's, you know, it's not okay when you're drunk. It's not okay when you're sober. And I think that he would have opened up the door to saying, yeah, I might have done that.
Yeah, I think he loses Murkowski on that. Can I ask you one more right before we let you go? Jeff Sessions today. See, the president has been acting very, very demure by his standard to the last couple, very presidential, very professional in his application of things. And he's been moderate in tone. And we, you know, if we take a little extra time, we're going to do this. It's the kind of thing that you see. And I thought, All right, well, he must be looking at his poll numbers, right? And he must be thinking, and his people must have said to him, listen, you're losing suburban women, you're going to lose even more here. This is going to cost, this is the difference between the House, the Senate, and your reelection in 2020. And he's listening, which tells me he can take instruction, which is, you know, at least for a period of time. Now, he this morning goes out and says, I do not have an attorney general about Jeff Sessions. And I mean, the United States has an attorney general. The president doesn't have an attorney general. What do you make of this? I mean, you've seen a lot of stuff, Mark McKinnon. What could this possibly, how does this end?
Well, it ends badly. I mean, I think that this all goes back to, the much bigger issue, which is the Mueller investigation, which is where everything started unraveling. And I think that Donald Trump wanted an attorney general who would protect him from any investigation. And I think the reason he's so wound up about that is that he thinks there's stuff there that Mueller knows about or is finding out about and is problematic, or else he wouldn't be so concerned about his attorney general.
Well, what could he know? And the release of these unredacted emails now from the Justice Department, from the FBI, does seem to be a shot across the bow at the FBI. And how many other agents, you know, you got Page and Strzok and Orr, all the rest of those people that know that they are in the teeth of the lion here, or the belly of the whale, or whatever it is, wherever they are, they're somewhere bad, right? But they know it. But what about all the other thousands of hardworking men and women there who are out doing their job and thinking, wait, what have I just put on an email? Or what am I, you know, or a text message, I should say, not an email. You know, what did I just text to somebody? And that it's sort of like why cops in Chicago don't want the audio in their cars, right? It's like, you know, who knows what you say when you're like not always doing your job.
Right. Well, Donald Trump, I think, said something about, you know, he wanted his legacy to be that he blew up the FBI. You know, that's how focused he is now on that pursuit. But again, that just sends all the wrong signals.
Oh, my God. I'd be happy if this name that fort in Poland after him, Fort Trump, tell him he's a success. He can retire now and go back to playing golf. It's all good.
There you go.
There's an answer.
Yeah. So it's only Wednesday. I'm sure we'll have a completely different show by Friday.
Yeah, I know. I know what I'm going to do. It's funny that you mentioned that. I'm going to track this for next Monday.
Yeah. It's a great idea.
I'm going to take this interview, and we're going to take all these things. And if I think the over under is one of these things making the show. One.
I'll bet the none.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate
Thanks.
It. We'll talk to you next week.
Get
Mark McKinnon. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Well, that's what we'll do. Mark McKinnon. All right. Let's check in with Judy Pilak. What's coming up at the top of the hour in the WGN newsroom?
California's biggest ever wildfire is now contained.
Brocon Show with Anna DeBlantis right here on 720 WGN. Our friend Mr. Richard Roper has just stepped into the studio.
Yes. Hey, Rich.
Hello. Hold on. I got to get you the right moment over here. All right. We got
Allstate headphones on now.
This is very cool. Sure. Yeah. This is so much fun because I am such a geek.
Yes, you are.
A geek about this that we have Shure, which is one of the great audio manufacturers, the microphones, the headphones, for microphones, though, they are the people who basically make, you know, the greatest American manufacturer of microphones, the greatest worldwide manufacturer of microphones, without question. But for, you know, for all wide variety of purposes, they're based here in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
They have always been, and they are just, it's such a proud thing that the world sounds like Kim Jong-un. I hate to bring them into him, but, jeez, you know, Kim Jong-un is sitting there using a Shure microphone in North Korea when he's screaming at people. I mean, it's like, they are such an amazing company that have created this. Everywhere in the world you go, if there's a live performance somewhere, someone is holding a Shure SM58.
Definitely. Yeah.
Classic. They have like their own museum here. They've got the one, like Roger Daltrey very famously would tape his up.
Yeah.
right? With
so cool.
with athletic tape, and then so he could swing them against the cymbals of Keith Moon's drum kit back in the day. And they have created this performance studio for us.
Oh my gosh, it's the best.
They are amazing.
Visiting bands never want to leave. They're just like, this is awesome. The sound is great.
And now they've given us these amazing headphones that have that Allstate is sponsoring, and they have the Allstate logo on it. And it's there. Yeah. It just is. I'm in geek heaven here. That's all I'm going to say.
Geeking
about.
Out.
Yes.
You guys are in my head. The sound is so perfect. Oh. It's like, yeah.
Hello.
I know. Oh, hi.
Hi.
I'm not stealing your head.
Oh, here we go.
Oh, see, that's when it gets creepy.
Yeah,
the wrong one gets in your
now
head.
Now I just want the ones with the yellow foam from 1977 when you do that guy.
Can you put those on, please?
Ted Cruz is in my head. Every time I see Ted Cruz, I think of what he's thinking in his head.
Oh, that's delicious.
No.
All right, here we go. We got to get right through this.
It's the top five on the Rokan Show.
Five.
Let's go.
4, 3, 2, 1.
Now, it's the top 5 at 5 on the Rokan Show with Anna Tavlantis. Sponsored by the Hip and Knee Center, where they help you feel new again.
Ready?
Yes.
Yes.
Get on with it.
Checking in at
number 5.
President Trump said he's not worried about Paul Manafort testifying against him.
No, I'm not. I'm not, because if he's honest, and he is, I think he's going to tell. As long as he tells the truth, it's 100%. He was with Ronald Reagan. He was with Bob Dole. He was with McCain. He was with many, many people. That's what he did. Paul Manafort was with me for a short period of time. He did a good job. I was, you know, very happy with the job he did. And I will tell you this. I believe that he will tell the truth. And if he tells the truth, no problem.
He also said in that, would he consider a pardon? He said, I don't want to talk about that right now.
Yeah, I don't like talking about pardons, even though that's all I was talking about before.
Hmm.
All right.
And that sound there, a lot of people think might be Marine One. It's actually Melania making a healthy drink for Barron.
Frappe. It's on frappe.
What about Brett Kavanaugh and these allegations?
I would say this. I think he's an extraordinary man. I think he's a man of great intellect, as I've been telling you. And he has an unblemished record. This is a very tough thing for him and his family. And we want to get it over with. At the same time, we want to give tremendous amounts of time.
All right. We'll see. It looks like Monday. Chuck Grassley appears to be saying that it's going to be a Monday hearing. If she would like to come testify, she's more than welcome. Mm-hmm. The FBI... I don't know if the FBI is going to be able to get an investigation done, but we were just told by Mark McKinnon that they have done this in the past in as little as 3 days. Could they do it? We'll have to see what happens there. But the president, again, day 3 and counting of a body double impersonating Donald Trump and acting calmly and presidential. So I congratulate the White House on that.
And his Twitter feed
number
as well.
4.
Okay, everybody, it's time to sing.
Wait. No singing here. No singing. I am admiring my bottle cap collection.
Yeah, but don't you want to sing a song, Bert?
No.
But, Bert, it's a ding-along song.
A ding-along song? Mm-hmm. What is a ding-along song?
Well, Bert, it's a song with dingers.
Okay. All right. The long-standing debate about Bert and Ernie's sexuality took a very strange turn. There is a guy named Mark Saltzman who won 7 Emmys for his work as a writer on Sesame Street between 85 and 98. And he gave a wide-ranging interview to the queer culture outlet Queerty, it says here. I'm reading that directly.
That's right. He did.
He discusses in this interview writing Bert and Ernie as a reflection on his relationship with his longtime boyfriend. Now, LeVar Burton, the host for Reading Rainbow, is not down with anybody who's not down with Bert and Ernie coming out.
It's very powerful. And for those who take exception to the fact that there is a gay couple being represented in a forward-facing children's show, you need to check yourself. This is a very diverse world.
Yeah.
And the world is made up of more families than just the traditional nuclear family, mom, dad, kids. We all need to see ourselves represented in the popular culture in order to develop a healthy self-image.
They're Muppets. They can't come out. They can't talk unless you talk for
what
them.
What was that dude even saying?
That's LeVar Burton, man.
Part of the Rainbow Coalition, or what was it?
Oh, my gosh.
All right. Look at this. Look at the kids. Look at the kids. It's like, the kids.
Activists.
Yeah. All right. No more Tucker Carlson for you tonight.
But it was, wasn't it? Wasn't he with the...
No, it was the Rainbow Reading thing. He's reading. It's LeVar Burton. He does children's television. Yeah. He was Kunta Kinte in Roots. He was on that Star Trek thing. He had the thing over his eyes.
I never even
very
watched.
Famous.
It's not the Jesse Jackson Rainbow Coalition.
And by the way, very quickly here, I just want to point out that the producers of Sesame Street said they're Muppets. They don't have a sexuality.
Yeah.
Again, issuing that statement for the 20th time.
Yes.
Obviously named after the cop and the cabbie from It's a Wonderful Life, as we know. Bert and Ernie.
All right. Richard Roper is being brought to us by Arkadek.
Oh,
I should mention that.
Thank you, Arkadek.
And I should also mention now that Judy's got the news headlines for the bottom of the hour.
On November 6th, you have the power to influence the course of politics following the most comprehensive local political news online, chicagotribune.com/midterms.
Checking in.
Number three.
A man who was mocked online after he was recorded shaving at his seat on a commuter train headed out of New York City, speaking out. Fellow passenger Pete, whose name is being withheld pending my ability to pronounce it, filmed Anthony Torres sitting in his seat on the New Jersey Transit train, steadily swiping away at his lathered face and tossing the shaving cream from the razor onto the floor.
What?
What? 2.4 million people have seen this so far. I'm going to just tell you that. This ain't right.
No, it's not.
Why were you shaving on a train instead of in a bathroom or somewhere else?
Because I just got out of a shelter, felt dirty, then take a shower, then shave. That's something of it because that's the way I am.
Were you self-conscious when this was going on? Like, did you feel bad? Like, maybe people will think this is...
No,
just,
no,
you weren't
no.
thinking about that at all.
No, I wanted to get clean. I wasn't thinking. I should have wiped the shaving cream that was on the floor. I wasn't thinking. God.
Oh, poor guy. He was actually spending time in a homeless shelter prior to this.
Okay. I you know what?
Trying to clean himself up.
He's still got it manners. All right. Checking in.
Number two.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Maroon 5 is going to host they're going to do the halftime show at Super Bowl.
Oh, yeah.
I just keep waiting for this band to go away, and they keep coming back.
Why do we have to? Why is it? What's wrong with Bruno Mars? We're gonna have him again
every year. Be fine.
Atlanta. That's the Atlanta sound, right? Maroon 5.
What's wrong with Maroon 5?
Skinny jeans.
Oh God.
No.
In related news, 110 million Americans just ordered swivel chairs. it doesn't.
Wow.
Does he have new music?
Yes, I would rather a new song with the Cardi B.
I would rather go see 16 Candles at a street festival.
100%.
Why don't we have them? I love them.
We have to have them
kidding?
Do this.
I love them.
Yeah.
I don't even know who that is.
Local band.
This doesn't work.
Number one.
Judy Cochran is the mayor of Livingston, Texas. Now she has another title to add, Gator Hunter. Ooh. She's a grandma. She caught a 12-footer, 580-pound beast on her family ranch along the Trinity River. And she said she's going to be mounting this sucker.
3 years ago, we came up missing a miniature horse. And they're about so big, about like a big lab. One shot in the head, and he just went under. Typically, they'll do what they call a death roll. And just roll over and over and over. Well, this one didn't. And I said, don't mess with Nana.
Oh, man. I'm not going to mess with Nana.
The top five at five.
Rokan Show, then at the Blanches, yes. Right here, 720 WGN's WGN everywhere on 720. There's White Sox on this. It is us. It is we doing the we thing.
That's right.
And this is the part where it gets a little wilder.
and weirder.
We
and
can swear now.
The language changes. People behave strangely.
No one behaves, period, is really what happens.
We're on the stream!
Right. The Violetta says the craziest crap on this.
And I only do that on the stream.
Yeah.
And we still get in trouble for it. What did you guys say the other day?
Right. That's true.
It's a stream.
That is true. I did have to have a meeting about one of our first ones. Mm. And they called me and they go,
just because you're on the stream, okay? Doesn't mean.
We're free. No FCC clamping down on us.
We like to refer to it as the X-treme, is how we like to refer to it.
Oh, I like that. Yeah.
So, several X's in there?
Mm-hmm. The triple X-treme. all right. So, but it's still WGN. I mean, this is the industry standard for behavior on a radio station.
I will be a class
usually. Broad. Yeah. Yeah. And you put the K in class.
Mm-hmm. Like school on Saturday.
It's real nice. All right. Listen, we got coming up in just a few minutes here. Anna Bursch is going to join us from the Chicago Blackhawks. And we are going to talk about the preseason. The Hawks opened. They opened last night. It didn't go so great in Columbus, did it?
Nah, that's all right. It's preseason. Most of the starters weren't playing. Cam Ward got his first action with the Hawks, but
the goalie.
Cam Ward is the one they signed. He'll be the backup to Corey Crawford, who, an encouraging sign, has practiced 6 days straight now, and he's doing some on-ice work. Of course, he missed time since December of last year. If Hawks going back to the playoffs, they need a fully healthy Corey Crawford, and right now he's trending up, so that's a very good sign.
It's a very good sign. Very happy about that. And we also have coming up on the program, Mr. Richard Roper will be here to tell us about Fahrenheit 11-9. That is provocateur filmmaker Michael Moore's take on the Trump presidency thus far. Which is interesting because he goes on to talk about how he thinks Trump's going to get reelected and then be the last president of the United States because the United States is going to crumble into an ash heap.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. So there's that.
Run.
And we did, actually. Very good run. And we saved the world. But, you know, this is a count
twice.
Now? I don't know. Yeah, twice. Thank you. Thank you.
No big deal. Yeah. We saved the world.
So we'll be talking about all of that. And we also are going to play for you, because Violetta, by the time we are done, will have done something that is going to require us to have a meeting during the stream broadcast. Uh-huh. And we're going to play for you the post-Van Dyke interviews that we did and after the Van Dyke trial today.
Yeah.
The analysis from Mike Monaco and also our Eric Rung's observations of what happened in the courtroom.
Very fascinating. Yes.
Really fascinating stuff today because a lot of stuff is happening here. So there we have it. And all right, well, you know what? There are no rules here. We can just dive right in.
Sure.
As a matter of fact,
what
do we know here about the Michael? Let's talk about the Michael Moore.
Sure, absolutely.
Situation here. So he did Fahrenheit 9/11. Right. In the mid-2000s, in 2003, 2004, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
About the whole, you know, the aftermath. What is America like now in the aftermath of September 11, 2001? Mm-hmm. And now he's turned it around to 11/9, the day after, November 9th, the day after that Donald Trump was elected president in 2016.
Correct.
And, you know, Michael Moore is one of those guys, always going to be a lightning rod. People are going to love his work if you agree with him. You're going to hate his work if you disagree with him. As a filmmaker, he's a very good filmmaker. He's very convincing about what he does. He likes to chase people. He likes to go knock on doors, ring doorbells, walk into the Trump Tower and try to do things.
Right.
What was your take on
the ambush interview?
Yeah, well, okay, so the Fahrenheit 11-9, as Ro mentioned, too, the reason he made that stretch was, if you'll recall, we went pretty deep into the evening, so it was actually after midnight on election day, the election was the 11th, 11-8, so it was after midnight when everybody was declaring him the winner. So that's how, officially we knew that Donald Trump had won the election on 11/9, although you're still going to see a bunch of people, probably myself, who are going to be typing in Fahrenheit 9/11 a lot because we're so used to that, or Fahrenheit 451.
Yeah, which is where it all started. Yeah.
So, I have mixed feelings, as you do, about Michael Moore. There's no doubt that he is a brilliant performance artist,
and nonfiction filmmaker. I almost hesitate to say documentary because he has never been someone who just wants to record something and document something. Well, most documentaries have a point of view, mm-hmm. but especially him. And he makes himself the star of the documentary. Starting off with Roger and Me, of course, which was his famous breakthrough film mm-hmm. where he wanted to confront the head of General Motors, right? You know, and it's, for people who don't know, Michael Moore's from Flint, Michigan. He's a Michigan guy. So he's always kind of been on the side of labor, and yes, he's very leftist. That was 30 years ago, that Jeez. Film, almost 30 years ago. So now he's got Fahrenheit 11.9. And I'm giving it 3 stars. I will say that. I'm recommending the film, but it's very uneven. It's 2 hours long. And actually, to my relief,
it's a long time for a documentary.
It is a long time for a documentary. I mean, there's a documentary about Gilda Radner coming out this week that's 86 minutes long, you know, and most of them are probably somewhere in between. To my relief, it is not a 2 hour diatribe against Donald Trump. It's not just a Donald Trump film. There's some Donald Trump stuff, of course, and he rehashes a lot of the things that we've already, you know, he does a whole montage about the creepiness with Ivanka and some of the horrible things he said. And he does have some great footage of Trump, like back in the day, like the NBC affiliate in New York. Is that Channel 4? Channel 4.
Yeah, they're
the NBC. So he's got footage of them preparing to do a news interview with them with Donald Trump, businessman, and he goes, well, I don't need anybody on the phone. And then he picks up the phone and he starts yelling at a guy named Steve, and there's no one on the other end of the line.
You know? Isn't that, but that's you the know, thing. That so, was right. Right. Yes.
So basically, and Michael Moore's point is, what did you people think was going to happen? We've known who this guy is for 40 years. And he's right. And, you know, you guys have mentioned that many times on this show. It's like, what did you think this guy was going to do? This is who he is. And Michael Moore, I have to give him credit, too, as he, of course, is never shy about tooting his own horn. He kept telling people 6 months, 8 months before the election that Trump had a real chance. And he's got a great montage of celebrities like George Clooney and people like Nancy Pelosi and George Stephanopoulos, you know, TV commentators, all saying the same thing. There's no way Donald Trump's going to be president. They all say it in various contexts about mm-hmm. 6 to 8 months before, and they're laughing. They're laughing mm-hmm. at that. And then Michael Moore's on the show, and he says, you know, I think he's got a chance. And they're all laughing at him. Wow. And he's like, well, yeah. You know, it's that arrogance and smugness that, right? You know, on the mm-hmm. part of the, if you want to call it the liberal elite. So there is that stuff about Trump. But what I like about it and admire about this film, too, is that a couple of ways where he goes after the other side. And one of them is Hillary Clinton. And he shows Hillary Clinton's team in Michigan, some of the women that are working for him, talking about, and this is before the election now, of course, talking about how they're not seeing any signs for Hillary in their neighborhoods. They're seeing one Hillary sign for every 25 Make America Great sign. And in Wisconsin, and they're talking about, we can't get her to come here. And Clinton's operatives, some of Hillary Clinton's operatives, actually are on record as saying, we didn't want her to go to Michigan or Wisconsin because we felt that would be a negative. And Michael Moore says, if the presence of your candidate is a negative, you have a problem. And they were in denial. And then he cuts, because he always beautifully, you know, cuts and manipulates footage, he cuts to Hillary on stage with Jay-Z and Beyonce, thanking them, thanking Chance the Rapper and Big Sean. And after he finishes, Michael Moore goes, she doesn't know who the bleep any of these rappers are. And it just was, it shows, you know, how she was completely isolated and smug and elite and, you know, is to blame as much as anybody else for her losing. Guess where you look? You look in the mirror. The other, I think, really provocative thing.
Right. You can walk around in the forest all you want
yeah.
and reestablish yeah. yourself with nature. But she lost. Let's call yeah. this what it was. She lost to one of the least electable candidates in the history of all elections, including water reclamation district in the city yeah. of Chicago, yeah. right, in the county of Cook, that you could possibly imagine.
And he knew exactly, as we've talked about here again, he knew exactly what he was doing and how to do it. And he also, and again, I you know give him credit for this, he goes after the Democrats too, because at the, you know, the Democratic National Convention, there were states in which Bernie Sanders had won almost every county. And then they would stand up and say the state of blah, blah, blah proudly cast its superdelegates and just went with Hillary. And he talked about the fact that there were a lot of states where Bernie Sanders had won,
And then they just, you know, and some of them did say, well, five delegates go to Bernie or whatever. But he said, a lot of people who are really involved in that campaign, say what you want about Bernie. They said, you know what? What's the use? My vote doesn't even count.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So totally. They didn't even bother then to turn out for the general election. And
a lot of moderates, you know, also did not come out because they were like, well, you know, she's good. I can't see myself voting for her, and I'm not going to vote for him. So, and he's not going to win. So what? You know, I don't want to be a part of this.
That was it too.
Yeah.
And the election night stuff, you know, where, you know, morning of New York Times, 85% chance Clinton's going to win. All the commentators and the parties, they kept playing that "This Is My Fight" song for Hillary. You know, like that. Remember that song? It was over and over, and they were singing and singing and singing. And in the meantime, over at Trump headquarters, people were miserable and just ordering, you know, drink. And then all of a sudden, about 10 o'clock, the music stopped playing in one hall, and people started getting, "Come back over here." And the other thing I really like about this film, and I'd say this is the most effective passage, is Michael Moore's shining the spotlight on the tragedy in Flint, Michigan. Again, his hometown and the drinking water crisis. And Governor Rick Snyder, a friend of Trump's, a businessman who, you know, the story's well documented, but basically said, you know, we've got this amazing, pristine, was it Lake Huron, right? Would be the lake and the Detroit River. So, you know, great water. And we're going to have instead the Flint River provide water to the citizens of Flint. The Flint River, which had dangerous amounts of lead. And as the scandal continued, they did nothing about it. And, you know, people got sick and people died. But Michael Moore really reserves a lot of his ire, as do some of the citizens there, for Barack Obama. And there's amazing footage. And I don't, honestly, I didn't remember this, but President Obama, he's, you know, maybe 6 months before the election, flies into Flint, and the citizens, mostly black, are like, okay, our guy is coming. They're talking about how he's the knight in shining armor. And he gives a speech to a hall filled with families who have gotten sick kids, people who have, you know, had Legionnaires' disease made a comeback, for God's sake, in Flint.
Gee.
And Barack Obama delivers perhaps the most tone-deaf speech of his presidency. He goes up there, he kind of jokes around, and then he actually says, "Can I get a drink of water?" And he goes, "Not a bottle of water, like a glass of water." And you could hear the crowd like, "This isn't funny." And he kind of pretends to drink from it and goes, "Oh, it's all right." And people were just appalled. They're like, "This isn't funny, and that water is not safe."
Raising your kids
and he
here.
Did it again at a news op later that night, where he was with Rick Snyder and a lot of the officials who were, you know, being really, really criticized for their horrible treatment of the people and their negligence, their alleged negligence. And then he got back on the plane and on Air Force One, and there's, you know, it's a really devastating segment where you see a lot of people who just worshipped President Obama and thought he was going to come in and save the day, and they said he came in and he made light of the situation.
Including Michael Moore. He was a big Obama guy.
So what do you give this?
3 stars for Fahrenheit 11-9. So it is not a two-hour attack against Donald Trump. He also spends a lot of time with the kids at down in Parkland, Stoneman Douglas, as they're starting their movement before they became super, super well-known, and that's pretty inspiring as well. So he's touching on different things happening in America.
Covers a lot of ground.
All right. All right. Anna Burrish is going to join us from the Blackhawks coming up right after we check in now with Judy. What's coming up at the top of the hour in the WGN newsroom? Rokan Show with Anna DeBlantis right here on WGN Everywhere.
Yes.
And Chicago, former Chicago Blackhawk, Adam Burrish. He's always a Blackhawk as far as I'm concerned.
Absolutely.
Joins us now on the Super Celebrity Hotline. And should I be worried about the preseason, Adam? Should I in any way be worried about it?
I'm on the Super Celebrity? How do I sneak onto this? How do I sneak onto this?
Totally an accident.
Oh, no.
I'm telling you, this preseason, it's going to be a blast. It's going to be really cool because there's a lot of opportunities open. Now with Connor Murphy and the Blackhawks announcing that he's got a back injury and he's out, all of a sudden these last two first-round picks the Blackhawks had, their defensemen, they're going to get some really big-time opportunities. And if there's a guy that you want to keep an eye on for fans that are going to watch this preseason, it's Joakim Harju, who's going to get some time with Duncan Keith. They want to see some different situations that they can put him in power play time, maybe. Stud defenseman, a modern-day defenseman now, where you don't have the big, tough, nasty defenseman. It's puck-moving. It's skating defenseman, and that's what this kid is. And in the scrimmage that they had this past Saturday, he showed some big-time flashes. Joel Quenneville talked about him in game one already, how he's impressed, had a great first showing. And then there's a lot of little pieces. I loved what made me excited was Joel Quenneville yesterday when they asked him, is your roster pretty set? You know, there's not a whole lot of spaces open, and he kind of caught himself. I think he wanted to say, you would be surprised at some people we're looking at and some openings that may be there.
Wow.
So this preseason, there's going to be a lot of opportunity for guys. Nobody's job's safe, and they always tell you that in the NHL going into training camp, but you know, sometimes as players, you know, the jobs are set. There's jobs up for grabs after what happened last year. So these guys are going to be competing at a different level in this preseason. It's going to be fun to watch.
Yeah. You know, and Connor Murphy, friend of the show.
Yes.
I mean, he's not as good a friend as you are, Adam, but he's a good kid.
Great answer.
Very impressive.
Yeah, he's really something. And you know, he's a hockey legacy guy. It's in his DNA, literally. So he's athletic, big. He's the kind of guy that you definitely want on the ice for the Hawks. And it looks like what now? I think they said 6 to 8 weeks potentially for that. So you are going to see some kids come up. Now, the key here on defense, one of the problems, obviously, you know, with Corey Crawford having been out most of last season, there wasn't a ton of blue line support either, right? I mean, that's an argument that I think is a fair criticism. So what can they do here? And if Corey Crawford is going to be healthy, and it does look like he's trending upward, right? Because he's now practiced for a straight week. We're getting some sense that he may be maybe not playing as many games as he would have in a totally healthy situation, but he'll be back. What else can they do on the D line here that they what would you like to see them do? Let's put it that way.
Well, first of all, I'll say Corey Crawford in the interview that he did, and I know Corey well, and I played with Corey. He wouldn't say if he's doing better if he didn't mean it. And he said, this is the best I've felt. I'm turning the corner. I'm feeling better. And when he says that, that's not lip service. If he says it, he means it. Otherwise, he wouldn't have done the interview. But he did it because he was confident in what he was going to say. So for me as a fan now, that was super encouraging. And this defense last year, just to be totally honest with you, they couldn't have been any worse. Everything that could have gone wrong for them. They will guaranteed be better. Duncan Keith is going to be an unbelievable defenseman this year. He is motivated. He trained his tail off this summer. He scored 2 goals last year. I can guarantee you right now, I'll put any money you want on it, he is not going to score 2 goals. He's going to be motivated, and he's hungry this year. So he is going to be better. You're going to see some young guys have to step into positions that we didn't think that would happen last year. They're going to have to up their game. When you put young guys or guys that have been told no before or players that are bubble players that are told they can't make it and you put them in your lineup now, they're going to raise their game. They're going to be better. Brent Seabrook's another guy last year that people criticized that he's coming back hungry. He trained his tail off this summer. I know. I saw him. He looks lean. He looks good. He's going to have a big year. He's going to have a bounce back year. These guys are motivated guys that didn't like the way the season ended. They've got a bad taste in their mouth, which again kind of goes back to preseason. The season starts now for these guys. Preseason games, when you see Duncan Keith, when you see Seabrook, when you see Taves in there, those guys want to start off the season on a good note, and that's what Jonathan Taves, Patrick Kane, they all said that. This is when the season starts. It starts today. It starts in the preseason. We want to kick this thing off on a good note. So I think it's going to be fun to watch how this thing goes, and I think people are going to see a different level of motivation from these guys.
Adam, you mentioned the young players. Alex DeBrincat is one of those guys, and he led the team in points last season at just, 19, 20 years old. He's been skating a lot on the line with Taves and Kunitz in the early going here. What sort of season, what sort of expectations should fans have for Alex DeBrincat, and how good do you think he can be?
Well, you talk about guys getting motivated for all different reasons. What's funny for me and for guys that know the guys on this team is Kane doesn't like when somebody outscores him. Kane and they have a friendly competition, I'm sure. So now Kane's motivated, saying, "Hey, kid, I know you had a good rookie year, but I'm coming after you this year. Let's have a friendly battle and see who can outscore who." But this DeBrincat is such a good kid. He's such a good player. His teammates love him. He's well respected. He works his tail off. He's a superstar. He's a future superstar in this league. He does things the right way. He's respectful. He's hardworking. It's not about him. It's about the team. He does things the right way. And if you've got a young kid that's a superstar on your team, you want them to be like Alex DeBrincat. If you're a young kid and you're trying to watch this team and who do you want to mold your game after, or how do you want to act, how do you want to play, DeBrincat's a kid that you want to be like, you want to act like, you want to play like, and any one of his teammates would tell you that too. So he's going to have just the same type of year he has last year. Quinville puts him in situations that he's always successful in. You can put this kid in any situation. He's not scared. He's not intimidated by anything. He's a superstar for this team, and he's fun to watch.
You know, it's funny because he reminds me a lot of Kane, and you know, this obviously is these great institutional legacy Chicago Blackhawks legends now are in the second half of their careers. You know, that obviously you want kids coming up here who are going to be something and excite the crowd. And I think that DeBrincat is one of those guys where you're watching guys a little smaller than the other guys on the ice, and but he moves in such a, I hate to say it, cat-like way on the ice, and he makes
nice
room. Thank you very much.
Well done,
it took me 3 weeks to come up with that. But he creates space around him the way that Kane does. And that's the thing that Kane's the best maybe that ever lived at creating space for himself to move the puck. And you're seeing, it appears that DeBrincat's learning, taking a page from that.
Yeah, it's creating something out of nothing. And if you're a player just like Kane that can create something out of nothing, or you're in a tight space and you think you're dead, all of a sudden you make an unbelievable player. You get yourself out of that situation where bad players like me end up turning the puck over or not making a play or getting rid of it.
Stop.
These guys can make something out of it. And like you nailed it. DeBrincat, he's an easy guy to cheer for. He's an easy guy to root for.
My nephew
loves
him.
He's an easy guy to like. And I love him, too. He's fantastic.
Wait, just quickly, Jokke Haru, you mentioned he's a rookie.
Yep.
What's his nickname? Do we have one for him yet? Because that seems like a difficult name to turn into something.
I hear some people say the Joker. Say the Joker.
Yeah, it works.
Yeah, I'm going to have to ask on that one, though, I thought I've heard the Joker a few times, but it's kind of a fun name to say. Jokke Haru.
It's impossible to spell. I mean, there's no way. It's just one of those names. But
Yokes.
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 Oh,
yeah.
Sorry, Joker.
Yokesy.
We'll tell him. That's what we decided.
Just keeping it simple. Always go with the simplest answer is always the best in hockey. All right, Adam, thanks very much, man. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Adam.
Talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me on the Rokan Show. I love you guys.
Thank you. Love you, too. Bye.
Bye, Adam.
Adam Burrish. He's the best.
He is.
Yokesy. Hello,
Yokesy.
Oh, Yoke, are you there?
How are you?
Well, his first name's Henri, H-E-N-R-I. So
Henri Jokke Haru.
Henri?
First round pick from last year, yeah.
How do you even do anything with the Hunt?
Yeah, well, we'll shorten that with a nickname once it gets established.
Yeah, well, Henri. You don't see a lot of, there were a ton of Henris when I was growing up.
Yeah.
Every French-Canadian guy was named Henri, but it's like one of those names that is no longer,
fashionable to be a Henry.
Right, it's no longer, that's the thing. You know, those are guys born right after the war. What are we going to name the baby girl? Maybe Henry. You know, so it's kind of the way it was in Canada, and it was in the United States. So you don't get a lot of Henrys anymore.
No. Yeah. And you don't see many Jokke Haru's either.
Yeah.
Jokke Haru's.
Jokke Haru's.
I got to get used to saying that one.
Oh, a Joker. Okay. All right. On the other side, Kanye is going to move the Kardashian clan to Chicago.
And she's got like a team of 25 people she needs around her at all times.
Yeah.
This is a big deal.
Wait till you, I cannot wait to get Violetta's reaction to this, because she's a big defender of the Kardashian clan. And will she be the one that takes them around town and shows them where all the hot spots are? We're going to find out about that. And Richard Roper will also tell us about some other movies that are coming out this weekend that you might want to go see. But first, Judy Pilex got the WGN news on WGN everywhere. Rokan Show with Anna DeBlancis on WGN everywhere.
Mm-hmm. We're everywhere.
Yes, right. Like dog poop is everywhere. Although not anymore. You know, people now are picking it up. All right, Richard Roper, let's talk about this. We got a couple. You said 3 stars for Fahrenheit 11-9. 2 hours is not just beating Trump over the head.
Right.
He's beating Hillary over the head, beating Barack Obama over the head. He's beating basically the American political establishment over the head.
Yes, looking at our broken system.
Okay. Now, Life Itself. Now, this is a movie from the creator of This Is Us, which means there are going to be a lot of long soliloquies and man crying
That's 100% correct. That's it. In fact, we can move on to the next movie pretty much. Life Itself. So, yeah, Dan Fogelman is his name. And obviously, This Is Us has become a huge TV sensation. Beloved by many, loathed by a few, but has won awards. And definitely, I think it's going into its fifth and final season now, right? But the final season, it's designed, yeah. But I mean, it was. Okay, so anyway, Life Itself is now Dan Fogelman's attempt to do a feature length film. He's done other movies before, he has directed some other films, and it's a multi-generational look at various families with lots of flashbacks and then flash forwards and then interlocking stories. So in other words, it's very familiar territory for those of you who are into This Is Us. Part of the story takes place in New York, and Oscar Isaac and Olivia Wilde play this young couple, and we get to see them and how they fell in love, and then we get flashbacks to her childhood, and then we get flash forwards to the child they have, and then all of a sudden, in the middle of all this New York stuff, we go to Spain. It's just all of a sudden, it's like, you know, chapter 3, the Gonzalez family, and then all of a sudden, there's Antonio Banderas as a very wealthy landowner in Spain who looks and talks exactly like that guy who was the most interesting man in the world.
Oh, great.
And he has an olive business, olive harvesting, and now we learn all about his story. And there's
care about any of these people?
Well, here's the thing. You know, there's a lot of really good actors. Annette Bening all of a sudden shows up here and
love
there.
Her.
And we get all these interlocking stories. And I would tell you, there is so much death in this movie. Ooh. People are always dying. And it's usually the women. Spoiler alert, what we hear a story about one young woman when she's a little girl, she was in the back seat of her parents' car and there was a huge accident. She saw daddy get decapitated.
Oh gosh.
And then there's another story about how somebody was abused until she shot her uncle on the knees and told him to stop it. Then we see the story of a pregnant woman who idiotically stands in the middle of traffic in New York City because she's like flirting
with
someone and she gets hit by a bus.
This is why I can't deal with This Is Us, because there's always something going on. Someone's house is burning down, and Sterling K. Brown's crying. I'm done.
On camera. They die off camera. There's a whole fantasy sequence where there's death.
It's honestly
horrible, and it's corny, and it's forced, and it's annoying. And if you liked Bob Dylan before this movie, you'll hate him by the end because of the way his music is used. It is one of the most astonishing, tone-deaf movies of its kind I've seen in many a year. I'm giving it 1 star, and I might be being kind to Life Itself.
Yeah.
Wow.
Don't have any interest in seeing
that. How about Love Gilda?
Love Gilda is a documentary about the great Gilda Radner, of course, who not only was a member of the first company of Not Ready for Primetime Players, but was actually the very first person that Lorne Michaels cast for SNL before he found, well, he knew who everybody was, but before he hired Belushi and all the rest, he started with Gilda because he knew that she was going to be lovable. And if you look back at some of the other great people who were on that early show, Chevy Chase, they were really good, but not lovable. And Gilda always was. She was at SCTV, and it covers all of that stuff when she was at SCTV in Toronto, National Lampoon Radio Hour, the brilliance of Saturday Night Live, and then her romance in the movie she did with Gene Wilder. And it's beautifully done. They had the family's cooperation, and they have all kinds of audio and written journals of Gilda. Her book came out 2 weeks after she died. So she was working on, not the audiobook, but notes and everything. So we have a lot of her thoughts, even as she knew she was dying.
Ooh.
And not only do we hear them in her own words, but I think the filmmaker, kind of a brilliant touch, Melissa McCarthy, Amy Poehler, Maya Rudolph, et cetera, read sections of Gilda's stuff.
Cool,
you know, so we see the legacy. 3.5 stars for this film. I really liked it. And she was just wonderful, Gilda.
Hey, Gilda Radner left a legacy well beyond comedy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Gilda's Club and all of that.
Right.
In terms of you know, turning the corner on understanding cancer and understanding the treatment of cancer and understanding the struggles of people who, you know, go through the long, arduous process.
And their loved ones, the people around them, which the center here is very good at helping you help them.
And nobody talked about it. Back in the day when stars were sick, they were just sick. And she was very open about it. And there's amazing footage of her welcoming all these people, having people come to her home and visit her when she was going through chemo. At one point, she was in remission and she went on It's Gary Shandling Show. That was before the Larry Sanders Show. That was the one where he talked to the camera and stuff. And she comes on there as Gilda and he's like, gosh, you know, I haven't seen you for so long. You know, we haven't been on, she goes, I haven't been on TV TV for a long time. I had cancer. What's your excuse? Which is just so great. Right. So she was really funny. 3.5 stars.
And a happening of monumental proportions. All right. You got Allison Janney, Jennifer Garner, who apparently it appears that Jennifer Garner's child support continues, but her alimony is over. She's in everything.
She's in everything lately. You're right.
Common, Katie Holmes, Rob Riggle, who we love, and Kumail Nanjiani. What's going on here?
Yeah, this is directed by Judy Greer, who's in everything, a famous character actress. You know her if you saw her this first night. So I think she got a lot of her friends to be in this movie because, you know, Common plays a nerdy office drone dad. Not good casting, by the way. It's all set either in the workplace or a school. It's one of those all these things happen in just one day. Different people going through crisis, and there's an affair over here, and there's a kid who's
clearly
over there.
As a play.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's terrible. It's really bad. It's sort of like a lighter version of life itself, you know, where you have all these characters, and then all of a sudden you find out, oh, that one's related to that one, or he knows her. It's really, really tone deaf. The humor is not good. It's slapstick, and then it's really, you know, triacly, terrific cast, completely wasted. 1.5 stars for happening in monumental proportions. Yeah, it's just unfortunate. It's really, I mean, Katie Holmes plays a paramedic who's talking with some sort of, I think, New York accent. I couldn't quite tell. And then Common's having an affair with Jennifer Garner. And then Keanu Reeves is Jennifer Garner's husband, and he calls up Common and he wants to fight him in the bathroom of a coffee shop. And it's just, what is happening with these people?
It's like the Real Housewives. Yes. Same kind of plot.
All right, there you go. So go see Love, Gilda, which is that's available in theaters.
Yes,
right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, check out Love.
Avoid
Gilda.
Life itself. Avoid a happening of monumental proportions. And Fahrenheit 11/9.
Yeah, people will walk out of Life Itself. It's one of those movies that's a walker outer.
Like
I'm telling you right now, because people are going to see the cast and go, "Oh, this is us," and they're going to take mom and they're going to take their sisters, and you're going to walk out about halfway through and say, "I can't take this anymore."
Okay, don't waste your money.
I've done that. Yeah. All right, now I know you got to run for a screening. You've got to play tonight, and you're going to run off to do that if you'd like. But I want to ask everybody, especially the kids here. Kanye has announced that he is moving to Chicago, and he really means it.
He's never going to leave.
Really?
Bring the whole family there and enroll the kids in school.
Right. Chicago.
Oh, parents' night's going to be so much fun.
Really.
Chicago's
going to... Parents' teacher conferences.
Wow. They have a kid named Chicago, right?
Yes, the third child is named Chicago.
Chicago West.
Chicago goes to Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Oh, my God. More kids coming. Portillo, come home. Get Chicago. So he's really going to move here, huh?
He says he is. Wow. He's moving to... They're moving Yeezy Productions here.
They already bought a house here.
That's better than Amazon coming here.
Did they know where they bought the house?
That is unclear.
Oh, what do you think?
That's unclear.
Right next to your house, Ralph.
Gold Coast.
Can I borrow her a cup of crazy? That'd be fantastic.
There's also a clip of them checking out his old house on the south side. North, that's their first daughter, and Kim went there with Kanye to check it out. And they have some clips on the internet, but not the full video yet.
Be a lot of noise because she was tailing their vehicles.
I'm a guess they're not moving there because at one point... Yeah. Mama Chris is going to step in
It's already happened, Ro.
What happened?
It's already happened. All of a sudden, after he announced they're moving there, they want to get out of the limelight, they want to be away from the paparazzi, they got a house, it's all happening, he's got going to have a studio there. Then Kim came back and said, I'm not moving there. I don't know what he's talking about. I want my life to be here near the kids, the family.
This is the end of Kanye and Kim. This is how it all ends.
He could buy. Isn't the Michael Jordan house still for sale? That'd be one of the few houses that would be good for that.
Kanye in Highland Park.
Yeah.
Just changing the number on the gate there.
Yeah, the 23.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Kim can't survive here. It's just, it's not flashy enough.
I think you're right. I don't think she could.
Like
be
Juliana Rancic couldn't even survive here. She's back.
That's true.
No, it's true. That's true.
They had a great life here.
She came with by all the jewelry on Oak Street, and then what?
You know,
where do we go? That's it. You know, that's amazing.
I don't know what to make of this.
Could you imagine though if your kid was like on the soccer team or whatever, and Kanye was out there, the awards ceremony, taking the trophy away from your kid, and giving it to his kid,
all denim uniforms.
Oh my gosh! I'm gonna say something right now. Chloe and Zoe did not deserve this. My
my kid was better.
He's going to do all skin color uniforms, just like his fashion
line. And all the new soccer shoes are going to be like Smurf shoes. And you won't actually be able to make contact with the ball. That'll be a problem. Yeah.
Man.
Yeah.
Tweeting, getting into a big Twitter war with like the vice principal of the middle school.
Yeah.
Mrs. Bronson don't know nothing.
Look out, Highland Park High School.
Can you imagine?
For when, because all the kids are going to have to go there because if he buys Michael Jordan's house.
Right.
Oh, man.
Which maybe he did.
I hope this happens. I really
do. Fantastic.
I think he'll probably live here for a little bit. And you don't know where he is anyway. He's never on the show or whatever.
Mm. Yeah, he could just bounce back.
He's probably getting sick of being in that Jenner Kardashian circle.
Oh my gosh,
he's not in the circle at all.
He not allowed.
No.
Not allowed.
He doesn't want to be part of that crazy, which if Kanye doesn't want to be part of it, you really know it's crazy.
Right. But yeah, that's true. It's like, I can't handle this.
You people are crazy. And I know from crazy.
I dream in cartoons, and this is too crazy for me.
The last episode
like,
where they actually feature him is in the Family Feud episode behind the scenes. Yeah. And, you know, Kim brought an extra friend, so then they get guy whatever. There's too many people, and everyone wants to play. So Kanye's like, yeah, no one's getting off my team. We're full. Bye. And he just leaves the room, doesn't even care. And they're like, no, we need to figure this out.
He's like the Jay
Cutler. He's Jay Cutler. Yeah. He's the Jay Cutler of this relationship.
How could there not have been a category in the Emmys for like most best reluctant husband in a reality show?
That'd be a so great topic.
David Foster.
Right.
And the winner again. The David Hyde Pierce of this category. Jay Cutler! Don't care.
He laughs them off more, though, than Jay. Jay's like, you're crazy.
Mm.
Meanwhile, Kanye's like laughing like, you guys are crazy.
Does he appear in the Kardashians that much?
No.
The Kanye?
No, he really doesn't.
Only to say, remember he made, this is how I knew that, remember how we were supposed to take the whole Caitlyn Jenner show, This Is Caitlyn or whatever it is, that seriously, because this is a really important moment. This is another one of those times where we got lectured to as guys, like, hey, you are going to behave here. This is a person who had the orientation dysphoria, and you're going to have to learn to accept Bruce Jenner as Caitlyn, and you're going to watch this show. Right? And so we watched the show, and I knew, and I did what I was told. I watched the show, and I'm about 12 minutes into it, and I'm like, oh, this is kind of interesting. Mm. Okay. I'm going to act like I'm interested.
Call her the right pronoun.
And right, exactly. It's a heart shape. You can't call me. And then all of a sudden, Kanye shows up, and they're introducing his new clothing line. And I'm like, oh, that has got Kardashian written all over it. It's just a product placement for the shoes that look like Smurf feet. Forget about it.
How about it?
And that ruined me. And from that point forward, I'm like, Caitlyn, you are a sellout too.
Are they gender neutral, the shoes?
Yeah, for sure.
Sure,
they're human neutral. A horse can wear those shoes.
Oh, man.
Oh, God. All right.
Well, here's to hoping.
Here is to hope. I don't see him. Where's he going to hang out here?
Volunteer crossing guard.
There's plenty of places to hang out.
He's
the culinary capital of the U.S.
And he's friends with
restaurants.
He's friends with Chance the Rapper now too, so he could chill out with him and Common.
Go to White Sox games.
He's just gonna do like crazy things up and down Michigan Avenue, and no one's gonna even know it's Kanye West.
Yeah, he'll do things like he'll be like the kids' volunteer crossing guard at the school, getting into
You know what you could buy? You could buy the Obama's place.
Oh.
You know, they're going to have that apartment over the museum or whatever that is, or they're just going to have that little deal. Yeah. Because they're never coming back. So you could buy the Obama's house in Kenwood, right? Right there on, it's from his neighborhood. It's close to his neighborhood.
Great neighborhood.
Right? What's wrong with that?
Bring Kanye to Chicago. I want this to happen.
I want him to come with Kim.
No, Kim's not coming.
I don't care about
Kim. She says she's not coming. It was just too much.
It would be fun to add to the circus. Give us something to talk about.
How many times a week can they go to Tao?
Oh, right? My gosh.
Like, there'll be a Tao, like 12.
Kourtney Kardashian was in town for Tao.
Could you see that? If I'm just trying to work the divvy thing and kind of getting so mad at the bikes. Getting caught in the rack and Kim breaking it. My gosh.
I'm told from people who were at the Tao opening, the big restaurant down here where Excalibur used to be, down at Ohio and... Or Ontario, I guess. Ontario and Dearborn.
Yeah.
Is that...
That yes, there was a Kardashian there, but there was so much security, and apparently it was like everybody who ever goes to opening night here, mm-hmm. it was like the Super Bowl of opening nights.
Oh jeez,
right? Yeah. And everybody was there. Were you there?
No, I wanted to be.
She seems crushed.
Oh god,
I was crushed. I was going through everyone's. Lourdes Duarte was there.
Why didn't she go? Well, they sent out like a million media invites.
Yes,
they did.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure you're on. Yeah, we all got emails.
Well, honestly, I didn't really even know it was opening, but then when I saw the Instagram, I just had major fear of missing out and was like, oh, I should have been there.
Yeah, and Courtney, and the people couldn't get closer. She apparently walked in, did a twirl, took off. Because I guess this is, you know, it's a Tao group, right? It's a New York-based operation, and they you know, landed. It's supposed to be a lovely space, amazing. I love Tao in New York.
Mm-hmm. The Vegas one's pretty wild.
I just don't know how, it's a big space.
The limelight before it was Excalibur.
Yes.
Remember that?
Yeah.
That was the
last time everybody in the world got invited.
Andy Warhol was at that.
That's
actually
true.
Andy Warhol. Which one was there?
Courtney? Yeah, she posted it on her Instagram.
See, if I walked in, I'd be saying, like, can I get a beer? I wouldn't even know which one.
You got Miller Lite.
I'm Courtney Kardashian. I'd be like, it's good to meet you. Okay, my server introduced herself by name. That's great.
You put the Sox game on and give me a Miller Lite, please?
Oh, gosh, you guys are bad.
I would not bring you guys with me if I went.
Yeah. Where's the bar? Can I get some buffalo wings? Extra hot, please.
You guys are the worst.
Oh, my God. Well, that's a funny thing. Listen, I just want to tell you, I've seen this movie. I've seen every movie already. I worked the opening of Limelight in 1985.
Dang. Oh, my God. Were you bouncing?
I was working as a public relations person I was working as a writer at a public relations firm. They sent me out because I was the youngest guy in the office.
So
I was still in college.
The guy who signed,
and they sent me out to go wrangle celebrities, including the kid from Gremlins or whatever was in town.
Zach Galligan.
We had to go pick him up. At Midway Airlines flew him in. When there was a Midway Airlines, we had to go pick him up. I had to pick him up in my Toyota Tercel and take him to Limelight for the opening.
Nice.
And it was going to be the biggest thing that ever happened. Yeah, it was great. And people and Andy Warhol was there, as you pointed out. It was like the scene. And that was the last night anything ever happened of any interest at Limelight.
Yes. So, like you said, it's a huge, it was a church originally, right? A giant cathedral or something.
Well, in New York it was, but the one here, that building was a museum.
It's a beautiful building.
It's gorgeous.
Growing up, I thought it was the medieval times.
Yeah, because
you're not going all the way out there. That's
fantastic.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Yes. I think it was the medieval times of herpes is what it was.
Oh, my goodness. There we go.
Yeah. Right. It was quite a moment.
There are a lot of buses pulling up to that.
Okay, so I'll make a reservation for all of us to go. Mm-hmm. I'll drop your name.
Well, don't worry. I think it won't be hard to get in. Because
you're right. It's huge.
It's huge.
I mean, it must be sectioned off into different areas and stuff, but still.
For the bottle service, too?
Well, it's a club. It's a club and restaurant, and they say they hope to gross $30 million, which would make it like probably even higher grossing than Gibson's.
Sure, go ahead with that.
They said they put $20 million into it.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it's a gigantic build-out. I mean, I wish them the best of luck.
Gorgeous.
I want them to do very, very well. It's a great Tao is the food is great. The nightclub experience in New York and Las Vegas and the place is great. I want them to do very, very, very well. Mm. I want them to win here, but I don't think it's that whole idea of that exclusivity thing in Chicago doesn't really work. They've tried it a number of times.
It just doesn't.
It's not that super celebrity thing. They still got guys like Kev who show up and go, I need the Miller Lite. Hey, why is the Sox game not at?
Put it on.
Bring it on his whole TV.
They're in Cleveland.
The only way they're hitting that number is if Kanye comes and starts ringing up that bottle service stuff. There you then.
Like every day.
Yeah.
And there will be, and it's all the club crowd will move to them for a while.
Yeah,
right?
But
and then the next new thing will start.
It's only so many yellow Lamborghinis.
I was
going to
say the club crowd in Chicago isn't that. Doesn't seem that big for this style.
Boris will go, don't you think?
Was he there? Was he not there already? I'm surprised.
Boris does not miss any opening nights in Chicago.
He was probably working the door.
I'll volunteer. I don't miss opening nights. Whatever it takes.
He comes dressed all in black with his headset.
Sunglasses on.
Nobody questions him.
Yeah, that's right. I'm going to now find out where is black guy. Get my car. Oh, hey, man, I'm Kanye West.
Kanye.
It's true, though. You look at what lasts in Chicago, places where they slaughter cows on a daily basis.
Yeah. Food.
And you get big slabs of beef, or bars where there's a picture of the grandfather behind the bar, and the grandson's now running the place.
That's totally true.
Even the seafood places have a hard time because it's lighter cuisine.
They've been there forever. Yeah. You know, legacy places and family-owned and all that good stuff.
And I think they will do, I think they'll do, they'll do a lot of tourism traffic. There will be a scene there for a while, but there's a lot of nightclubs that, you know, have that. They got a 2-3 year arc. I do suggest, and I think people should probably be able to get in after the first week or two, that people go check it out because it's it one of the things too in New York. There's a lot of kids that go to it. I don't know what they're going to be doing here.
What do you mean by kids? Like Dave and Buster's kids or like young 22-year-olds?
Oh, I mean,
kids?
That's the thing. Yeah, like in the
kids.
Tao,
like
in Midtown.
Kids?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Tao in Midtown. Yeah. It, I took my daughter there when she was 10 years old.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Hmm. That's how long that thing's been open, by the way. I just want to point
out. See, like, Kelly Ripa and Mark Consuelo.
Yeah, their kids with their kids and stuff, So, you know, like, so it's like, you know, they don't quite have the exact same video games as Dave and Buster's, but they're, you know, but there's a gigantic Buddha, and people want to go get their picture with the Buddha.
Right. Okay.
All right.
Okay.
I wish everybody the best of luck.
All right, good luck with that.
Judy, I don't need to keep you any
longer. I won't be there if you're wondering.
Trust me.
Yelling at all the kids.
Hey!
Hey, mister, where's your parents?
Hey, Boris, where's Kanye?
You know what? Maybe I will go. Yeah. Just Boris, for that.
Kanye? Get back in line. Just a single file.
Am I on the list? There is no list. What?
I just show up and say, how you doing? And they go, just park.
Right, exactly. Hey, I'm going to have Miller Lite, too. Put the White Sox game on.
I might go with the Cubs.
Why don't you go with the news?